And because of the worry about drugs, because they do have side effects, the very large coronary drug project was started. 8,300 men were put on several drugs to lower cholesterol level. They were also put on placebo. That is, a number of men were put on just an empty capsule that looked like all the capsules that had the drugs, but this had no drug at all. It was a 5-year double-blind study. That means that neither the doctors who gave the capsules to these men or the men themselves knew what was in the capsules. All the capsules were coded with special numbers, and nobody knew but the investigators that held the key of the code. 5-year study. The men originally came in with cholesterol levels averaging 250. At the end of the study, they dropped 6% to 235. And they had figured out that if the men had dropped their cholesterol from 250 to 200, which is a 20% drop, about half the deaths could have been avoided. Such a tragedy. A 20% drop in 5 years, and we can drop your cholesterol 25% in 3 weeks. Well, the tragedy of the Mr. Fit study was that the placebo, the empty capsule, did as good a job in preventing deaths and preventing side effects as all the drugs combined. In fact, the placebo was just as good as any of them. None of the drugs helped you if you didn't change your diet. Now, if drugs don't work and diet doesn't work, what do you have left? Well, you have left ileal bypass surgery, sort of a desperate move to drop cholesterol level. Would you believe that it's being advocated that you slice out a third of your small intestine, your nice 20-foot small intestine, you take 7 feet out just to drop your cholesterol level? Well, that's something that the federal government is paying for to test right now. They're actually paying for millions of dollars to have 1,000 people have their intestines sliced to drop cholesterol level. And when I first found out about this from the National Institutes of Health, I was just shocked. And I saw a recent article in the Los Angeles Times, because Dr. David Blankenhorn of University of Southern California is recruiting a third of the patients. And the reporter said to Dr. Blankenhorn, well, if you want to reduce cholesterol level to stop heart disease, why don't you go the American Heart Association diet? Dr. Blankenhorn said, I know, but that diet will only reduce cholesterol 6 or 8%. We need at least a 20% drop in cholesterol to reduce heart disease and to show a reversal of artery closure. And the reporter said, well, do you think this operation of slicing out the intestine was going to do it? Oh, yes, he says, that will drop it 25 to 35%. And the reporter says, do you see this as a way for all Americans to, in effect, become gutless? And Dr. Blankenhorn said, no, he said, there aren't enough surgeons to go around to slice everyone's intestine, but if it works out, we'll find a nice drug to lower cholesterol level. So even after all this work showing that drugs won't work, the moderate American Heart Association diet don't work, Dr. Blankenhorn still thinks the American people are not smart enough, if they're given a real diet that'll lower the risk factors and lower the cholesterol level, that they'll follow it. So we've got to try and convince the health professionals that the average public is far smarter than they think, that if they're given the right advice and enough information, they'll select a diet to save their lives. How about exercise? Many people feel that if you exercise, you can forget about everything else. Well, there are examples for this. For example, in East Finland, the number one in heart disease deaths in the whole world. And who are these people that are dying there? Well, they're lumberjacks, lean, muscular lumberjacks. They're eating about 5,000 calories a day to keep up their energy, but it's mostly dairy products. Tremendous death rate. They have more widows there in the 30 to 40-year-old range than any place in the country, any place in the world. And in North Karelia, which is one of the worst death rate areas for heart disease in East Finland. In fact, North Karelia has been number one in Finland in heart disease deaths. They decided to take the matters in their own hands, and they've cut down on their fat and cholesterol, and in 4 years' time, instead of number one, they became number four. That's what you ought to do. It's just a little community, a little county of 180,000 people, but that's the way to do it. How about marathon runners? Does running save you? Certainly not. Every day you find a story about a marathon runner dropping dead while he's running. I know, I remember the case of Goodloe Byron. He's a Bethesda, Maryland congressman, and he had run six marathons in his 40s, And one day he was doing a nice, easy 10-mile run, and he just dropped dead while he was running. They opened him up and looked at his arteries, and they were massive, filled with plaques. Wonder how he's able to run at all. No, running isn't going to save you. If you're going to be on the American diet and you want to do vigorous exercise, don't bother having yourself examined by a physician. Just see a good lawyer and make sure your will is in order. How is it that the experts are so confused? Recently, there was a large press release by the National Academy of Science saying that cholesterol doesn't even count. Dr. Olson wrote the report, and Dr. Olson's convinced that everybody should have their share of eggs and meat and so on. The fact that he is a consultant and gets paid by the very agencies he wants you to eat their products, like the Meat Institute and the Egg Institute, of course, doesn't affect his mind. He eats his eggs even if they weren't working for them. And he confused a lot of people because he completely ignored the scientific evidence in this country and abroad. He only examined the American Heart Association studies that everybody knows has failed. And he said, well, the American Heart Association studies have failed, therefore, all diets will fail for heart disease. And that's unfortunate when you have experts like that that confuse the public. I should say that as far as examples, the best example would be, as I mentioned at other times, the Tarahumara Indians, because there is a group exactly on the diet I prescribe. They have tremendous endurance. They can run 150 miles without stopping. Heart disease is an unknown quantity with the Tarahumara Indians, and with probably 35 populations around the world that have been studied. So as far as heart disease is concerned, we've learned quite a bit. And I think probably the main thing we've learned about heart disease is that it's preventable, and in many cases, it's reversible. And if we go to the experts, like Dr. Robert Whistler, University of Chicago Medical School, and Dr. William Castelli of the Framingham Study, they're going to convince us that if we can get cholesterol levels lowered so that your cholesterol is below 150 to 160 when you're 50 years old, or I might say below 100 plus your age with a maximum of 160, that your thoughts about heart disease would not have to frighten you, because the chances of you getting heart disease then are very, very, very slight. Certainly a fraction of what's happening in our country. You would be well advised to take the words of the experts, the progressive experts, and the results of our kind of studies and the many studies around the world that have been done, and to follow it. Now, this dietary approach, as I advocate, is now being accepted by large medical institutions. For example, UCLA has now modeled a program called CHEER after our diet. UC Davis is using our diet almost exactly as it is to lower cholesterol levels most effectively. Doctors around the country are using this diet. I would say there might be over 3,000 doctors using this diet now for their patients. And we send them little diet pamphlets to help them prescribe the diet to their patients. So there's no question we're getting acceptance all around the country, in fact around the world, using this dietary approach. It certainly demonstrates that thousands and thousands of people are interested, if they can only get the information, to change their diet to save their lives. In fact, I think the people are far ahead of the health professionals in adopting these ideas in order to help themselves. And I hope that in the period to come, when the American Heart Association is really forced to recommend to the American people the recommendations they now are recommending in the Mr. Fit study, the largest study they've ever had, by that time, that's a little late though, that'll help the rest of the country. But as far as you're concerned, you know what to do right now. You've got to get your cholesterol level down below 160, and heart disease then should be something that is just a vague memory. I'd like to give you some insights into the relationships of nutrition to angina. Angina, as many of us realize, is simply an insufficient blood flow through the coronary arteries to the heart. The heart, after all, is a muscle like the muscle in your calf or the muscles in your arm, and in order to be able to function, must have adequate blood flow. Now, you can have a certain amount of blood flow that would be adequate, but if the oxygen quality of the blood is low, it's in effect having not enough blood flow. There's a few ways we can cut oxygen quality of the blood down. One is by smoking, because the carbon monoxide in cigarettes chemically make a bond to the red blood cell and paralyze it for 12 hours at a time. So it's very easy to paralyze 5, 10, 15% of all the red blood cells in your blood circulation, and this way dropping your oxygen-carrying capacity very considerably. So smoking itself can give you angina even if you're sitting in a comfortable chair. Now, in the same way that smoking damages your red blood cell, high-fat meals, the typical American kind of meals where almost half your total calories in fat, creates a similar problem. The fats get into the bloodstream as you digest them, and the blood gets so coated with fat particles all over that the fat actually coats the inside of the artery linings, coats all the cells, and the red blood cells, you have a fine layer of fat all around them. The fat acts as an adhesive, and when two red blood cells hit each other, as they frequently do, they stick together, and pretty soon you have a clump of red cells stuck together. Now, normally, the red blood cells, being twice the size of the smallest blood vessels they have to go through, usually bend themselves in half and slither through the small capillaries. But when they're stuck together, they can't bend themselves anymore. It's like a solid cork. It's like a cork in a bottle. It goes to the small capillary, which is, again, is only half the size of the red blood cell, and just blocks it, and it stays there. Now, as the red blood cells are stuck together, those surfaces cannot pick up oxygen. And, of course, the parts of the body where the circulation is completely cut off because the clumps of cells are not permitting circulation become starved for oxygen, starved for blood. That, too, can create angina. We know by Dr. Peter Kuo's work. Peter Kuo was a Philadelphia cardiologist when he did a study, and he took 14 angina patients, and he asked them to come to his office, and he says, "Don't have breakfast, I'm going to feed you." And what he did was to tape them up with electrodes from electrocardiographic equipment, monitor their blood to see how much fat was in their blood, and then he fed them a glass of heavy cream. 4 to 5 hours after the glass of heavy cream, he registered 14 angina attacks, and yet they were just comfortable in his office, doing nothing special, just letting the fat get into the blood, make the cells sticking together, block the small vessels, and creating coronary insufficiency. The electrocardiographic results also demonstrated coronary insufficiency, whereas in the beginning, there wasn't any. Now, Dr. Kuo wanted to see if it was the amount of fluid that these people had or what it was, so a short time later, he gave the same patients a drink that had no fat at all, but the same amount of fluid and the same amount of calories. 4 to 5 hours after the test, there wasn't a single angina attack, not a single abnormality in the electrocardiogram. We've established through the years that fat is an enemy if you have a circulatory problem. Other investigators like Dr. Meyer Friedman at Mount Zion Hospital in San Francisco had invited 41 firemen to come to his clinic, and what he did was to give them a glass of heavy cream to drink. He was surprised to find when he looked in the small vessels around the eye that 4 to 5 hours after the drink, when the fat had come into the system and blocked small vessels, that he could count 25 blockages in the little area that he was observing with his microscope. About 9 hours after the fat had been taken in, the cream had been drunk, the blockages resolved and the fat left the blood. On another day, he took the same firemen and decided to give them polyunsaturated fat, safflower oil, because it was around this time the American Heart Association was saying, change your diet, but the only change you have to make is the kind of fat you're using. Use polyunsaturated fats instead of saturated fats like butter and lard and margarine. Use corn oil, use safflower oil. So Dr. Friedman wanted to see what happens when you give them safflower oil. He made a drink about the same amount of fluid, the same amount of fat as he did the butter fat, the cream drink, gave it to the firemen, and 4 to 5 hours after the drink was amazed to find that the amount of blockages were identical as with the butter fat. The fat made the cells stick together and blocked the small capillaries just as effectively as if it were cream. So it didn't make any difference whether it's saturated or polyunsaturated. The vessel blockage happened just as well. And at that time, Dr. Friedman had a warning in his article that was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association, in which he said, The recommendations should not substitute one fat for another, but should decrease all fats. That was in 1965. How long does it take the American Heart Association to read their own literature? Because just a short time ago, in the bulletin of the New York Academy of Medicine, Dr. Friedman said, and I'll quote him, "A meal rich either in animal or vegetable fat can lead to sludging of the blood and block capillaries for most of a 24-hour period where one fatty meal follows another." At this writing, he said, "I know of no single phenomenon that has been so consistently neglected in the study of heart disease as this one. Later, we may rue this inexcusable oversight." Well, fortunately for you, we're not overlooking this phenomenon. You have the facts, and now you can act upon them. It's a tragedy that the tremendously high-fat diet that Americans eat puts them in a semi-stupor almost all their lives, and you especially know about it after a heavy meal because they fall asleep in their chairs. So angina is a problem that we can help by eliminating smoking, eliminating the fat from the diet, and of course, if we get our cholesterol levels down so that arteries don't close any further, then you will not worsen your problem. Because the various authorities are in agreement now that if cholesterol level is higher than 160 milligrams per cent, arteries will close. Sometimes we're very lucky and we can go to 180, but it's in that range. To be safe, our blood cholesterol should be no more than 100 plus your age with a maximum of 160. If you can get your cholesterol down to that levels, hopefully then you're not only will your arteries stop closing with cholesterol deposits, but there's a chance of reversing the closure and opening the arteries to some extent. There are a number of primate studies, a number of human studies that bear this out. Reversal of artery closure is an accomplished fact in a number of studies where cholesterol has been dropped in the blood and in the diet sufficiently. Now, many people who have angina are concerned about exercise and so on. And I can say frankly that 99% of all those with angina can exercise and exercise well. In fact, as you, those who are at the center remember, we give you a target heart rate, and we teach you to go right up to your target heart rate, which is quite a bit of exercise. And upon time in the future, you're able to reevaluate your target heart rate and be able to have a higher level of exercise. So that walking is certainly something that anyone who has angina can do. The whole idea is, first of all, to start out by warming up. That is, walk slowly for 5 or 10 minutes in a warm place. Then continue walking at your normal pace. Now, if it's the weather's right and you're not cold, you should have no problem. If you start to experience any angina, you immediately slow down to perhaps half the speed. And if your angina goes away, then you go back to the speed that you were originally walking. If it doesn't go away, you'll have to stop until it goes away then. Now, if it persists for more than 2 or 3 or 4 minutes, 5 minutes after you've stopped, then you may have to resort to some of your medication. But normally, in 95% of the cases, it'll disappear then, and you won't have to worry about medication. The pain will go away by itself. In most cases, you'll be able to simply slow down and then go right back to the pace you were. And that way, you'll be able to walk long distances, at least 20, 30, 40, 50, 60 minutes, and eventually develop enough new circulation so that perhaps your angina will never come back and that your need for medication will be far less than it is now, or it can be none at all. We've had many participants, many alumni, who no longer have medication for angina, and many of them have passed normal stress treadmill tests, showing that they have now a full level of activity, unlimited activity, even though at one time they did have angina. We have many patients who have had angina that are running 5, 6, 7, 8 miles at a run, and have been doing that for a couple of years. So we know that it can be done, and it's simply up to the listener to decide to do it. Now, as far as heart disease, the best-known authorities like Dr. Robert Whistler of the University of Chicago Medical School and Dr. William Castelli of the Framingham Study, they both tell us that the whole process of atherosclerosis, that is, narrowing and closing of the coronary arteries specifically, is not only preventable, but it's reversible, simply by modifying your diet to bring your cholesterol and fat intake down. Now, many people resort to magic in trying to help their angina, like taking vitamins, vitamin E, and so on and so forth. I can tell you straight out that don't waste your time with vitamins. They're not going to help your angina. If anything, they can worsen you, because the body has to take care of these extra chemicals, process it, and get it out of the system. In all of the various double-blind tests that have been done with vitamin E, none of their tests have shown that there's any advantage in taking it over taking nothing. Weight reduction has not helped people with angina. In a study done and reported in the British Heart Journal, people with an average weight of 210 pounds were put on the program, where half of them reduced their weight to normal, about 40 pounds. The other half had no weight loss at all. And yet, when they were tested on a treadmill a year later, there was no improvement whatsoever in those who had lost weight against those who had not lost weight. Obviously, none of it changed their diet. So that weight loss is not an answer. You've got to change your diet if you're going to help yourself with angina. The diet plus the exercise program would be ideal for those who want to return to normal function. Now, angina, of course, is prevalent and many, many people have it. But I would say that the real growing epidemic in our country is high blood pressure, hypertension. The term hypertension is a bad term, because many people think it has to do with tension. It's got practically nothing to do with tension. It's just like heart disease is a bad term, because unless you've had a heart attack, there's nothing wrong with your heart. It's just that your coronary vessels have narrowed or closed, and so your heart muscle is starving for blood. Now, hypertension, in 90% of the cases, is called essential. There's nothing essential about hypertension. The term simply means that the medical profession says that they don't know what caused it. I think I can tell you what causes essential hypertension. There are two principal reasons for most hypertension. One is increased blood volume, and the other is decreased flow, blood flow. Now, in order to get increased blood volume, it's very easy to do. All you have to do is eat the normal amount of salt the average American eats. The average American eats about a third to a half an ounce of salt a day. Now, this just happens to be about 50 times more than the body needs. And the body is very fussy about its salt to water concentration. If you have more salt than the body needs, the body will hold a certain amount of water to keep the concentration exactly the same. So the average person, with the amount of salt they eat, could be holding 5, 10, 20 pounds of water just to keep the concentration of salt and water the same. People don't realize what a burden is carrying 20 pounds of water. But the heart knows all about that, because it has to push all that extra fluid around. Pushing that extra fluid around takes more work for the heart, and then will increase the pressure, because it's harder to push so much fluid through the body on the same amount of pressure. So pressure will go up if you're going to increase fluid. Now, the second way you raise blood pressure is decreased flow. If you're on a normal high-fat diet that most Americans are on, you're going to have many, many of your small capillaries 100% blocked, as Dr. Friedman has pointed out, because the fat coats the small red blood cells and platelets. They clump and they block small capillaries. So you can have 5, 10, 15% of all your small capillaries 100% blocked 24 hours a day. Well, if you're going to block your various little channels that your blood flows through, the body has no choice but to increase the pressure through the other open channels in order to give you the blood flow that you have to have every minute. There's no question that if we drop the fat in the diet and change nothing else, blood pressure will drop. Dr. James Iacono, who at that time was head of human research, U.S. Department of Agriculture, demonstrated that. He took healthy men and women, about 50 years old, and placed them on a standardized American diet and watched them in his laboratory. The standardized diet was 43% fat, about 10 grams of salt a day, about a third of an ounce of salt, and he watched them very closely. They stabilized their weight. Then he made only one change. He dropped the fat from 43% fat to 25% fat. Now, he kept the salt exactly the same, a third of an ounce a day, and he kept the calories exactly the same. He didn't want any of them to lose weight, because I don't think he wanted anyone to say that if their blood pressure dropped, it's because they lost weight. Within 10 days, all their blood pressures dropped 10%, both the top number, the systolic, and the bottom number, the diastolic. And not only did their blood pressures drop 10%, but their little platelet cells, the ones having to do with clotting, these cells were sticking together to a certain amount in these people, and 50% of the sticking disappeared. The stickiness broke up, and the cells now were freed and were able to individually circulate in the bloodstream. Well, this was a sensational discovery for Dr. Iacono, because the sticking of platelets is directly correlated to what we call diabetic retinopathy, the damage that diabetics do to their eyes. The more severe the tendency towards blindness for diabetics, the more these platelets stick together. So here Dr. Iacono was able to note a very simple procedure, just lowering fat to 25%, and this could have a great influence in helping diabetics from going blind. Well, he kept them on this diet for 40 days, and during this period, their blood pressure stayed down to 10%, and the platelets also were only sticking half as much. He then returned the fat to the 43%, and everyone's blood pressure went up 10%, and all the platelets stuck together again. It was a marvelous test because it indicates here is a program, a study with no weight loss at all, no change in salt, and yet a 10% drop in blood pressure. Fat is indeed a potent cause of elevated blood pressure. Now, many people are concerned about blood pressure because they think it's going to blow out their arteries, because that's what people usually have strokes from. They have an aneurysm in their arteries in their head where the vessel blows out and they bleed, and that bleeding blocks a major part of their brain from circulation, and they then lose that brain function and could be paralyzed or some other problem for the rest of their life. Healthy arteries, first of all, are not damaged at all by high pressure. Not an acute high blood pressure. In dogs, experiments have been made bringing their blood pressure up to 6,000 millimeters of pressure without hurting any vessels. Well, the problem is the long, continuous, elevated, chronic high blood pressure over many years that create the problems in humans. Like the Japanese, for example. They're on a very high salt diet, as much as 1 ounce a day. And the Japanese have probably the highest incidence of hypertension in the world. And incidentally, they have the number one stroke rate in the world, too, mainly from sort of blowing their brains out, their arteries finally weakening until they burst. So salt is not a good idea, and certainly is a leading cause of high blood pressure. Now, drugs do nothing to cure high blood pressure. All drugs do is to paralyze the body's mechanism to raise blood pressure. And many patients, while their arteries are continuing to close, in fact, some blood pressure drugs accelerate the closing of your arteries, so will accelerate heart disease. Now, the drugs have many side effects. And in fact, in studies done with the drugs, the one investigator who has had the original study that initiated using drugs and recommending drugs for physicians, for their patients, Dr. Edward Fries of the VA hospital, himself did a study where he took 60 people and took them all off drugs without their knowledge. That is, he gave me an empty capsule, looked just the same as the drug they're taking, so they didn't know when they were being taken off their antihypertensive medication. And in a period of time, almost all their blood pressures came back to where they were before they were put on medication. Now he watched the worst ones, that is, ones who had the most abnormal blood pressure, and put them back on drugs without their knowledge again, just by putting drugs in the same capsules that they were taking. But a number of them he left off drugs, and he watched them for about 8 years. Now those off drugs still continued taking those capsules with no drug in at all. So no one really knew what was going on there, as far as the patient's concerned. After the 8 years, he analyzed the death rate and so on. He found that 14 patients died in the 8 years. But what was amazing was that 13 of them were on high blood pressure medication right to the day of their death, and their blood pressure was maintained right in the normal range. So the blood pressure drugs certainly didn't protect them, because only one died who was off drugs. And this blood, the one person that died off the drugs had elevated blood pressure when he died because his pressure wasn't being controlled. The reason I understand that I would think that the 13 who are on drugs died is because they were the worst cases. That is, they had the highest blood pressures, and therefore they would have the greatest artery damage. And since drugs have a tendency to many times raise cholesterol level and so on, I would guess that the drugs accelerated their death by helping them close their arteries faster. Drugs have other side effects too. For example, a study done in Circulation, a publication for cardiologists, indicated that in this study, 50% of the males on high blood pressure medication lost the ability to have erections. They became impotent. General weakness, sleepiness, other problems with these men. And the problem with the drugs are even more than that, more serious than that. For example, many drugs will force the uric acid level to go up into the gout range, and then you have to take medications to bring the uric acid down to keep you from getting gout. Other hypertensive medications force your glucose elevated until you go into the diabetic range and have to take diabetic medications like insulin and so on. And it's possible in a number of patients to bring them into kidney failure with the hypertensive drugs. So that it's not good as far as the side effects to have someone on drugs for the rest of their lives. However, if there's no other way to do it, I would have to recommend that people with high blood pressure should go on drugs. There is another way to do it, however, and that is in our center's first 900 patients that we've analyzed, and they've been gone from the center now since 1977, September, we found that out of these we had 218 hypertensives that came in on drugs for their hypertension. And yet in 4 weeks' time, 85% were off their drugs with normal blood pressures, and some had been on drugs for 20 years for their hypertension. So we know that there are other ways to get people's blood pressure normal without having to put them on drugs and not having to face the side effect of drugs. And yet, the medical profession has recently had what we call a consensus. It was the first time that all the medical groups have decided that there should be one common treatment. And the consensus information was released from a Department of Health, Education, and Welfare bulletin. And here's what it said, quote, "For the first time, this country's medical associations and authorities have reached a consensus on an approach to diagnosis and treatment of blood pressure." What was the consensus? It's very simple. Drugs on a daily basis for a lifetime is the only way to manage hypertension. Now, if you read the 25-page instruction sheet to physicians, you will find about four lines that say, if you could ask your patient to lower salt intake and lose some weight, that might be helpful. That's all they said about nutrition. Very little. Now, they don't have much faith in nutrition. Now, there are many problems associated with drug therapy. In fact, the biggest problem is, of course, getting a patient who has no symptoms, because hypertensive patients usually have no symptoms, getting this patient to take drugs which gives them symptoms. And that's why authorities like Dr. Norman Kaplan and others have said that the most difficult part of management of a hypertensive patient is to make them take drugs which can make them feel worse. And in a book that he wrote called Clinical Hypertension, the reviewer said this. He said, it's in this area where the physician, the personality of the physician, must come into play to convince the patient intellectually and emotionally that they must remain on drug therapy for the rest of their lives. What the reviewer had in mind is making the physician an ally to the drug industry, to convince them that it's a lifetime effort for drugs and there is no other hope for you. There are many problems with the drug therapies I've mentioned. And 30 years ago, Dr. Walter Kempner demonstrated with his rice fruit diet that blood pressure is far more effectively treated with diet than with drugs. He got people's blood pressure down that were thought impossibly brought down by any other ways, and is still more effective today. Now, Dr. Kempner's diet is considered to be low salt, but people forget that it's very, very low fat. His diet is only 5% total calories and fat, almost one-tenth of what the average American diet is. And I feel that it is fat more than salt, that makes Dr. Kempner's diet and our diet, which is also about 5, 6, 7% fat, be so effective. The drug companies are pushing their product with intensive campaigns. They have, for example, hypertensive, high blood pressure search Sundays. Ciba Pharmaceutical, for example, got tied up with the Louisiana Heart Association and did a search campaign, a hypertensive Sunday in New Orleans. They found 30,000 people. They were able to take their blood pressures on that Sunday. They got 1,000 volunteers. They equipped them with blood pressure cuffs, car tables outside of supermarkets and so on. 30%, about 10,000 people found to be hypertensive. They were sent to their physicians to have drugs for the rest of their lives. Now, CBA already has done this to probably a million people. They've had hypertensive search Sundays, and out of the million people, if we go by the same ratio, it's about a third, about 300,000 people sent to their physicians to have drugs for the rest of their lives. I just calculated out what this public service is, because CBA pays all those expenses for getting the volunteers down, getting the high blood pressure cuffs and so on. And I figured out that there might be several $1 billion worth of drug sales involved. Now, it's just incidental that CBA happens to be the largest producer of hypertensive drugs in the world. But I think that they're still doing it as a public service. They're certainly not interested in the money. Because in an ad CBA had for one of their drugs, hydrochlorothiazide, they said, a note, for nursing mothers, if you're on our thiazide drug, don't breastfeed your child. Why is CBA so concerned about the child? Well, because the note continues to say, because thiazides pass through the breast milk and can make your child sick. Now, there's no hint in there that CBA says, why don't you change your diet so you won't need our drug? No, it's better than not to nurse your child. They're willing to destroy the child's health just to make their sales in thiazides. I call that a public service. So as far as hypertension care, what we have to look at is drug use as an exceptional use, something where you can't control any other way. And that probably would come down to about 5% of all the cases that are now being used for drugs. It'd be very nice if 85 or 90% of all people with hypertension never have to use drugs for the rest of their lives, for that matter. And you certainly can do it if you'll keep your fat intake and your salt intake down to the levels that we recommend. Thank you.